Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to another episode of Deterrence Down Under with the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. I'm Natalie Treloar, and I'm here today with Dr. Christine Lear and Carl Rhodes. Today we are joined by Jim Stokes, who is the Director of Nuclear Policy at NATO. Jim became the NATO Director of Nuclear Policy in November 2023. He's responsible for developing and implementing NATO nuclear policy, organizing exercises, policy symposiums, training programs, and providing support to the Secretary General on nuclear deterrence. Jim chairs the Nuclear Planning Group staff group, and prior to NATO, Jim had a long career with the US Department of Defense, holding positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Naval Special Warfare Command, and the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. He has earned his master's degree from the National War College and the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, as well as a BA from Allegheny College. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on today.
So just a reminder that the views of the host and the guests are their own and don't represent any institution with which we may be affiliated. So to provide some context for American and Australian audiences, Australia is one of NATO's partners in the Indo-Pacific region. Together with Japan, the Republic of Korea and New Zealand, the Indo-Pacific is important for the NATO alliance, given that the developments in the region can directly affect Euro-Atlantic security. NATO and Australia have been engaged in dialogue and cooperation since 2005. Priorities in NATO-Australia relations include upholding the rules-based international order, promoting an understanding of global security issues, enhancing interoperability between NATO and Australia, and engaging in issues of common interest, including cyber defence, countering hybrid threats, resilience, women, peace and security, and new technologies. Australia also participates in NATO Mission Iraq as operational partner. Cooperation is underpinned by regular high-level political dialogue, including an annual bilateral security strategic dialogue. So we thought it might be of interest to discuss how extended deterrence works at NATO, NATO's role in the Indo-Pacific, the strategic challenge posed by China, specifically its nuclear build-up, and how NATO needs complementarity and coherence between conventional and nuclear deterrence and defence. So, Jim, my understanding is that the NATO 22 strategic concept clearly states the fundamental purpose of NATO's nuclear capability is to preserve peace, prevent coercion, and deter aggression. As long as nuclear weapons exist, NATO will remain a nuclear alliance. So with that, Jim, would you like to start by providing us with the NATO Nuclear 101, that is, how extended deterrence works at NATO?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Natalie, Christine, Carl, thanks for having me on the podcast today. It's a real pleasure. I haven't been to Australia in years, but I feel like I'm there with you right now. So it's just a great chance to talk with you and your listeners there. And then just to reiterate that I am speaking in a personal capacity today and not on behalf of NATO or the U.S. government. So nuclear deterrence has been at the core of NATO's mutual security guarantee and collective defense since the creation of the alliance in 1949. And, you know, just earlier this year, we celebrated NATO's 75th anniversary, which also means 75 years of NATO being a nuclear alliance. And our allied heads of state and government have continued to reiterate the importance of nuclear deterrence, including in the 2022 strategic concept that Natalie just mentioned, and highlighting that, yes, as long as nuclear weapons exist, NATO will remain a nuclear alliance. Now, you know all very well that in order for deterrence to be credible, you have to have three things: effective capabilities, the political resolve to use them, and effective communication to an adversary. So let's talk about that within a NATO context. What is NATO nuclear deterrence? And I'll break down each of these three components. First, let's talk about the capabilities. So we have to have effective military capabilities which can successfully accomplish a nuclear mission. Obviously, it's not enough to just have the political will to use them. You actually need to be able to have those types of capabilities. The allies here within NATO have invested significant resources to ensure NATO's nuclear capabilities remain safe, secure, effective, and hence credible, especially in light of the deteriorating security environment that we're facing now. So at NATO, we really focus on our theater nuclear forces. These primarily consist of dual-capable aircraft and personnel that are certified to conduct a nuclear mission, as well as four deployed U.S. nuclear weapons here within Europe. And we refer to these as NATO nuclear sharing arrangements. There's nothing actually being shared per se. The United States maintains absolute control over its nuclear weapons. What these really are bilateral agreements between the United States and several allies to either host U.S. nuclear weapons or provide those dual-capable aircraft. And, you know, they came about back in the 1950s, and since then, they've been a visible expression of the U.S. extended deterrence commitment to NATO, as well as the shared burden among all the allies. But it's not the only way that the allies contribute to NATO's nuclear mission. They can also provide conventional capabilities to support a nuclear mission, which is something we call conventional support to nuclear operations. These are primarily air capabilities, but they can also include other joint capabilities such as land, maritime, special operations, etc. Our nuclear posture here in Europe, we believe, is already extremely effective, as demonstrated in our annual nuclear exercise, Steadfast Noon, which is coming up next month. And it's being strengthened by the transition to modernized B-61 nuclear weapons provided by the United States and to the F-35A, the world's first true fifth-generation fighter, which we are in the process of transitioning to that platform for the dual-capable aircraft mission. And then our three allied nuclear powers, the United States, United Kingdom, and France, they're all modernizing their strategic nuclear forces, which are, of course, a vital contribution to alliance security. And then collectively, this is very much a shared political and military burden across the alliance for our mission set. Next, let's talk about political resolve or the political will to use those capabilities. Now, here at NATO, we have something called the Nuclear Planning Group. It was established back in 1966. It meets at the level of the defense ministers. And currently, we have 31 allies that participate in the NPG. And the Nuclear Planning Group is the senior decision-making body for NATO's nuclear policies, its plans, its posture, pretty much anything that governs NATO nuclear deterrence. France is the only ally that chooses not to participate in the NPG for a variety of reasons, but it also contributes to alliance security in other ways and also through nuclear deterrence. So the allies in the NPG maintain full political control over NATO's nuclear forces, which means we don't have any decisions that are delegated down to the military in peacetime crisis or conflict. The NPG defense ministers have to authorize any and all nuclear-related actions. So, and this is a really important point for us here, those NPG allies hence share the political burden involved with nuclear consultations and decision-making. We have to reach consensus on any decisions that we would make, including any changes to our posture or force management. And in order to facilitate the negotiations and the consultations across the alliance, we do a lot of things to do what we call raising the nuclear IQ. So we have allies that share intelligence. We host different events. We share a lot of information and discuss these issues. My team and I do a lot of work directly with allies, you know, flying to Capitol and talking about these things. We do a lot of public speaking, podcasts, even with our NATO partners, such as this, as a way to sort of talk about some of these issues and make sure there's a good understanding across our allied leaders, but also from our publics about nuclear deterrence issues. And then finally, the third element is communications. We have to have effective communications in order to support deterrence, but we have different audiences. Of course, we have to communicate our resolve and demonstrate our capabilities to an adversary to reinforce deterrence. But here at NATO, we also need to reassure over 1 billion people in allied nations that we protect, and that we're taking prudent measures to deter aggression. So that's sort of the flip side of my mission set. We want to deter an adversary, but we also need to reassure our allied populations. And we also need to continue to explain why our nuclear capabilities are needed, especially in the face of, you've got the nuclear ban treaty advocates, you've got skeptical nations in the global south who aren't quite sure whether nuclear weapons are needed, and then increasing attacks by Russia and China on NATO's nuclear sharing arrangements. But from our perspective, we're in a world where there are increasing threats and challenges from authoritarian states with nuclear weapons who seek to undermine that rules-based international order that you mentioned, and they want to reshape it according to their values. And from our perspective, nuclear deterrence remains the cornerstone of alliance security, and I'd argue the security of all U.S. allies, including Australia.
Thanks, Jim. That was really interesting, those points on NATO. There was quite a lot there that I've actually learned myself. Christine or Carl, do you have anything there to add?
So has there been a change in thinking around nuclear issues given the past, you know, 3 or 4 years and the threats that Putin's been making around nuclear, the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the theater? Have things changed? Or have they stayed roughly the same in terms of NATO?
That's a good question. I mean, I think from my perspective, things have changed quite a bit. I need to rely a little bit on some historical perspectives provided by other colleagues here at NATO, because when I arrived here at headquarters, it was February of 2022. It was the same week that Russia invaded Ukraine at full scale. So that's kind of been my perspective, how long I've worked here at headquarters. And you know, both from the U.S. delegation to NATO and now on the international staff. And, you know, from my perspective, working with the allies, they are fully in support of what we're doing to bolster nuclear deterrence. I see a lot of support across the alliance. There's a lot more support publicly. We do polling research with different allied nations. We've actually had consistently high numbers of support for NATO maintaining its nuclear capabilities. And then also trust in NATO's nuclear alliance, even predating the full-scale invasion back in 2022. You know, in the past, reportedly, you know, these issues have been perhaps more difficult to talk about. They are still somewhat, you know, politically sensitive. And of course, with, 31 not sovereign nations within the nuclear planning group, that's a lot of different viewpoints. And we have to work really hard to get consensus on those things. But once we reach consensus, it really is ironclad or steadfast, as we like to call it. So I'd say what has significantly changed is our view of the threats that are out there. We're very much focused on the conflict that we see in Europe right now. We are very focused on the threats, the nuclear threats coming from Russia, both in terms of all this irresponsible nuclear rhetoric that it uses, which it comes at a fairly high volume, its development of new and novel capabilities, its, you know, potentially changing its nuclear doctrine, what it may or may not be doing in Belarus right now with stationing of its non-strategic nuclear weapons. And, you know, we have to take all that into stock in terms of our policies, our plans, our posture. And, you know, as I mentioned, the capability modernization, which those plans started years ago, but it's a great time for us to be making some of those transitions. As the Netherlands announced just in June of this year, they fully made that transition to the F-35 in the dual capable aircraft role. So I'd say from our perspective, we absolutely are focusing on what we need to do to continue to enhance deterrence. And, you know, as maybe we'll talk about later, how we need to make sure that we're coherent with the conventional side of the house and everything that NATO is doing there to bolster our defense.
Right. Thanks, Jim. Oh, Christine, you've got a question?
No, please, Natalie, go ahead. If
you go ahead.
Oh, cool. Jim, so I'm really interested in your perspective, you know, because I know almost nothing about NATO. Study mostly Australian history and Asia Pacific history around nuclear strategy. I would be fascinated to hear, you know, as sort of nuclear strategy becomes more of a thing in the Asia Pacific with China's purported nuclear expansion and modernization compared to the United States, which hasn't modernized since the 80s. My God. I'm really interested. The alliances system in the Asia-Pacific is very different to the European theater. Like, so Europe, it's mainly a land theater, contiguous borders, a lot of political same goodwill and sort of same threat perceptions. That's not really the case in the Asia Pacific, or at least there's a lot more nuance around that. And just the conventional military logistical challenges of U.S. power projection in our region are very different to Europe again. Like, but I'm really interested to hear your perspective on not that there would necessarily be like an MLF, the multilateral nuclear force that was proposed by the United States in the 1960s. But I'm really interested on the future of extended nuclear deterrence in the region, because again, the US has this hubs and spokes system in the Asia Pacific. So in 2011, I think it was, like, the US proposed a specific sort of nuclear planning dialogue with the ROC and then Japan. And Australia didn't really get that for different reasons, but I'm really interested in what the future of extended nuclear deterrence looks like in the Asia Pacific. And I'm not specifically asking for comments. I'm just interested. Like, what might be some of the lessons learned from the European experience for the Asia Pacific region, given that it is so vastly different.
No, that's a great question. And Christine, you've definitely done some historical digging, mentioning the multilateral force. I've also been doing a bunch of research on this. I mean, it's interesting to see how we sort of evolved to the overall structure and organization we have at NATO for our nuclear mission, both in terms of capabilities, our posture, but also our decision-making bodies and the consultations process we have. Because back in the early part of the Cold War, I mean, it was very different. I mean, one, we had a lot more U.S. nuclear weapons that were put here. The geography of NATO obviously was very different because of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. We had a lot less nations within NATO compared to where we are now. And there were some very different proposals that were put forward that, from my perspective, given how we've done things for decades, looked very, very different. So like this multilateral force that you mentioned was actually kind of put forward by the United States as it was an idea or a concept of how the nations could contribute funding together, and they could buy different like surface ships and submarines and have mixed manning crews and, you know, different nuclear weapons from the US and or the UK put on board. And it was a very interesting proposal at the time. And then concurrently, the U.S. was also putting its nuclear weapons here in Europe through those bilateral agreements, those nuclear sharing arrangements. We didn't really have a good consultation process among the allies. That sort of started to evolve with the Nuclear Planning Group. And there was actually a predecessor body before it called the Nuclear Defense Affairs Council. And the NPG was just actually one of three working groups, and it eventually became like the primary decision-making body. Well, what they found was with these somewhat ad hoc groups that came together, they were discussing these issues and they realized we really need to understand, like, how do we have political control over the use of nuclear weapons? How do we align our political objectives with the military plans? How do we think about use control? How do we talk with each other and have consultations? I was even able to dig up an old document that came from the committee that I now chair, where they started to put forward, like, these are framing questions for nuclear consultations that, you know, either the ambassadors or the defense ministers should actually consider. Because if we got into a crisis or a conflict with the Soviet Union, how would we even talk with each other? What were the questions we would ask? And let's turn to a different part of Cold War history and talk about the NPT. So these were sort of competing proposals that were going on with this multilateral force. And then there was sort of a related proposal from the United Kingdom at the time called the Atlantic Nuclear Force. And then in more of the NATO context, you had these nuclear sharing arrangements. SHAPE was doing a lot of planning with nuclear weapons. And then you had the Nuclear Planning Group. And as the NPT was coming about, so the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, you know, it was being drafted. It was a big momentum from a lot of different nations to say, look, we need to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. We don't want to see further proliferation. And these proposals were very much in the public domain. The U.S. was consulting with its NATO allies about it, but, you know, we were also talking with the U.S. was talking with the Soviets about it. I mean, it was fairly well known because it was talked about in the press. And from what I understand, I mean, the Soviet Union was very concerned about this multilateral force. There was a concern that West Germany would have access to nuclear weapons or develop its own nuclear weapons capability. There was a true concern about further proliferation after France and the United Kingdom developed their own independent nuclear weapons capabilities. And so a lot of momentum to create what became the NPT Treaty and when it entered in force. So the Soviets actually preferred the latter option, which is what we've had since then, which is these nuclear sharing arrangements, because even though the U.S. nuclear weapons are here in Europe, they remain underneath U.S. nuclear control. Only the president can make decisions for those weapons. They're not made collectively. We have sort of a different process when we're looking at a NATO nuclear mission, but the president still has to make a separate decision for U.S. nuclear weapons use. And the Soviets were okay with that. They were okay with what we call nuclear sharing, which is really, again, sharing that burden across the alliance and thinking about the consultations process, and even having dual capable aircraft, allied pilots that can employ U.S. nuclear weapons. They were okay with all that. And the historical record shows this, even though the Russians and now apparently also the Chinese are pushing back on this narrative and saying they didn't agree with this, but be that as it may. But that was seen as a better alternative to some of the other things that were considered at the times. And then we've persisted through to this day with that. It's changed a lot because, again, we've doubled the number of allies that are in the nuclear planning group. Obviously, our geography has changed. The number of weapons has gone down significantly since after the end of the Cold War. But to come back to your question, I guess, Christine, we really value the consultations process. Again, you got to have the capabilities. And we certainly appreciate, we've had some allies that have longstanding commitments to provide dual capable aircraft or host U.S. nuclear weapons. But the real value is in that consultations process. And I think this is something that is different in the Indo-Pacific region because of the hub and spoke alliance structure, if you will. I'm really encouraged that the U.S. is talking to the South Koreans and the Japanese. When I've talked to different delegations that come here, they're curious about how does this sort of work at NATO? And I think it's really powerful that, you know, U.S. allies can talk with the United States about nuclear issues and they can have a common understanding of these things. They can have a dialogue. They can share their own perspectives about this. The U.S. listens, and, you know, whether it's the U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region or out here in Europe, we need to consult with each other. We need to, you know, understand where we're coming from. And here at NATO, it's even at another level because we have to have consensus decisions. And, you know, no ally in the room can dominate the conversation, to be honest. That's my perspective. We really do need to work hard to come up with those, you know, shared perspectives of threats and what we need to do to address them. So I think it's really encouraging to see that. And, you know, to kind of bring it back to what we're doing as NATO with our Indo-Pacific partners, as you mentioned, I kind of think of this as like cross-regional deterrence and defense dialogue. I mean, it's, you know, on both sides of the United States, if you're right, on the Atlantic side and the Pacific side, you've got allies that are relying on the U.S. for extended deterrence. And we are all thinking about how can we sort of snap into that? How can we support integrated deterrence, as the U.S. calls it? And even though most of these nations, with the exception of the UK and France, they're non-nuclear weapon states. They don't have nuclear weapons, but I do believe they have really important capabilities that they can contribute, ways that we can bolster deterrence overall, and really, I think, raise the threshold for aggression against any of our nations and any of the different alliance structures we have.
Right. Fascinating. So if we all decide to go nuclear, we may be able to get some flexibility there in our negotiations.
I would not recommend that. There are sanctions and other things that could come from that. But I, you know, sometimes people do ask me about extended deterrence and, you know, how's that working out? And I said, look, it's never been easy. It's always been hard. You know, it is hard to have that sort of credibility, I think. But I think we all collectively work really hard at it. And actually, I don't have any concerns about it at all. So I think we're in a great place and getting better by the day.
In terms of extended deterrence, though, I mean, we've got China building a lot of nuclear weapons, according to various reports coming out of various organizations. We've got Russia that potentially will drop out of the START treaty complex. And so what are the real challenges that the United States and other Western nations find in terms of extended nuclear deterrence, given this changing nuclear environment from a bipolar world to a tripolar or even multipolar world, if you look at North Korea building more nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know if your audience thinks, like, why does NATO care about China? You know, it's on the other side of the world. But there is concern out here from, all 32 allies, but even for our European allies. I mean, we watch this pretty closely. Obviously, China has been modernizing and expanding the number of its nuclear warheads for quite a few years, and everything is doing on the missile side. Developing a triad, and it's at a pace and a scale that no other nuclear power is undertaking right now. You know, 500 warheads and then potentially 1,500 warheads by 2035, basically within a decade. That's a real concern. I mean, especially if you couple that with the delivery systems it has, the range that has. It extends across the Indo-Pacific, across the United States. It can even range over here to Europe. And all this expansion is happening with, you know, essentially no transparency from China, unlike what the U.S. had with the Soviet Union and then with Russia, where there was decades of arms control talks. China has not been interested in having any dialogue. It doesn't really have any interest in nuclear arms control. And, you know, what's even more worrisome is this really close strategic partnership between China and Russia, which is something that we watch out here. We're obviously very concerned about Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine. And we do watch those nations that are enabling it. China, North Korea, Iran, they're all supporting Russia in different ways. And China and Russia, as nuclear armed states, they have an ability to really kind of undermine that rules-based international order. And I think something that we kind of wonder about is, what lessons is China learning about nuclear deterrence and nuclear coercion from this ongoing conflict that Russia's had, and how it's sort of used its nuclear capabilities to try to intimidate both NATO or the West. And, you know, if there's a conflict that happens somewhere in the Indo-Pacific region, it's going to have repercussions over here. Global security challenges, economic security issues, there's sort of a ripple effect of, when something happens elsewhere in the world, it can draw attention away and resources. We saw this even just, you know, with the conflict in the Middle East last year, and how that sort of drew attention and resources away from what's been going on in terms of Ukraine and our support there. So I think from a deterrence perspective, I mean, it's fairly well known now that the United States is facing a significant challenge with China increasing its nuclear arsenal to a point where it may have an equivalent number of deployed nuclear weapons as the United States and Russia does. I will also say we don't know when China's necessarily going to stop or what its trajectory is. It hasn't stated that. So it's building nuclear weapons, and we don't know what that trajectory is. And again, without an interest in arms control, we don't know where that goes. Well, I think the implication for the United States has been made very clear by the Strategic Posture Commission report, which I encourage everyone to read. It's basically a strategic nuclear forces challenge, but also a theater nuclear forces challenge and a non-nuclear challenge that the U.S. and its allies in both regions need to figure out, how do we continue to deter aggression in either region? And if conflict happens somewhere, and there's, as you know, a variety of different ways it could come about, we need to make sure that we also deter opportunistic aggression in the other region. So our front sight focus is really going to be on Russia and how we maintain deterrence here in Europe. But we are absolutely concerned about, you know, what could happen over in the Indo-Pacific region. And, you know, even though NATO doesn't have a role within the Indo-Pacific region, that's not our area of responsibility. I'd say each of the individual nations, they all have different interests, they have different commitments. And, you know, just like they're doing with our support to Ukraine, every nation is going to make a decision about, you know, which side it's going to come on and how it wants to be able to support the United States and, you know, all of their allies and partners around the world.
Christine, do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I've got a sort of quickish, but not really quickish question. I was just I had an email exchange with one of my old professors this week, and then he was talking about, you know, again, China's nuclear expansion, and it reminded me that, you know, the nuclear age is so very young in the history of human warfare, and I think we tend to forget that a lot because we were so optimistic at the end of the Cold War, you know, Francis Fukuyama and all that jazz, that we've tended to remain in the state of thinking, oh yes, China will only ever have 300 nuclear warheads deployed, whatever, minimum deterrence postures, so forth, that we haven't ever really expanded our thinking like, maybe China will have 3,000 plus warheads, maybe Pakistan will have 3,000 plus warheads, like, why not? I think there's some presumption there from the West that, you know, only what we currently conceive of as superpowers will have large, what we consider large arsenals, or historically speaking. And I think it's just really interesting, you know, because we're not getting rid of nuclear weapons anytime soon, whatever we desire. And we might as well get smarter about thinking about nuclear strategy and so forth. And in that context, to take it back to the contemporary era, Jim, I'm really interested in your thoughts, or thoughts in general about, you know, President Emmanuel Macron saying, you know, France will be a provider of extended deterrence to Europe. And it got me thinking to a piece I wrote and others have written about, like, what does it take for a non-superpower state to extend deterrence, because only the United States, arguably, as a superpower, has extended nuclear deterrence. So I'm really curious to hear perspectives, thoughts about what you think about, you know, a country such as France, or Great Britain for that matter, to extend deterrence, like, given, like, the traditional requirements that we've seen from that concept, like, you know, deploy conventional forces in theater, have declaratory policy around conventional forces, around nuclear forces. And I'm wondering, to what extent in the future could a country like France or Great Britain be a provider of extended deterrence and not just the United States?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I'd say that there probably are different models, and they've been around for a long time now. I mean, you're referencing, like, what President Macron said in 2020, but I mean, even prior to that, I mean, France has had this aspect of considering that it's vital interest, right? So to go into French nuclear deterrence quickly, I mean, France developed an independent nuclear weapons capability really for the defense of France, and has maintained it ever since it was created back in the 1960s. And as I said earlier, you know, France does not commit its nuclear forces to NATO. They are for France's defense, if you will, from a nuclear deterrence perspective. And it has kind of a unique view on nuclear deterrence. It doesn't ascribe to conventional deterrence the way that maybe we do in other countries. And I actually think it's a really interesting point, and I tend to agree with it. They never want to see the dilution of nuclear deterrence. So France's posture is essentially sized so that it can cause a lot of damage, like a lot of harm, if it gets to that point, right? So that's how it maintains deterrence against an adversary. If you attack us, or, you know, invade us, or, you know, whatever the case may be, they can respond with nuclear weapons and essentially, you know, cause a significant amount of pain, of cost imposition, if you will. And that's why France can also size its nuclear deterrent essentially about the same size as the United Kingdom. They actually have fairly similar doctrines there. France has said that its vital interests go beyond the borders of France. It has sort of extended these commitments to the Benelux countries, so Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, also to Germany. There's been a lot of agreement with the United Kingdom over time. Essentially, like, if your interests are threatened, our interests are threatened. So the UK also has a similar type of commitment. The United Kingdom is also, since 1962, it dedicated its nuclear weapons in the defense of NATO. So it actually has what I would call an extended deterrence commitment as well. It's a little bit of a different context, as you're right. The UK does not have four deployed nuclear weapons here within Europe. But its nuclear weapons are there to protect the United Kingdom, and it also in a NATO context. So getting back to the French part of it, my read on this is France's vital interests do have a European dimension. France's interests would be impacted, if you will, if there was potentially an attack on a NATO ally along the eastern flank, as an example. I like the fact that France maintains some ambiguity in terms of its policies. Its decision-making process is really not any different from the U.S. president or the U.K. prime minister, and that it goes up to the French president. And the fact that there's some ambiguity there, it causes a potential adversary to pause and think about, I'm not exactly sure what they're going to do. And from a NATO perspective, this is why we think we have a very high threshold for nuclear use, because you've got three allied nuclear powers with separate decision-making centers. And then we also have the nuclear planning group, which includes two of those allied nuclear powers. And we have a separate decision-making center. And that's all very complicated for a potential adversary to kind of to nug through. And so I think that actually is a great way of sort of thinking about this. I think you can think about extended deterrence in different ways. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to have like forward deployed nuclear capabilities, but I do also think you need to have certain types of capabilities and posture, and having theater nuclear forces, strong conventional capabilities, and strategic nuclear forces, you need a mix of all three. That's a, sort of the modern triad, if you will, in order to be able to deter a potential adversary at multiple levels. And then you do need to tailor that to the adversary. I don't think that China and Russia think about nuclear weapons in the same form or fashion. I don't think that India and Pakistan do as well. I think every country has different ways of looking at the strategic utility of nuclear weapons. They have different ways of viewing threats from other nuclear armed states, obviously. And what I think we try to do within an alliance context, and then also with our different partners, is make sure we have some common views on these things. But it's never identical. It can't be cookie cutter. You're going to have very different views on these things across the sort of political spectrum and then within each country. But again, I think that we need to continue to think about not so much just, you know, what capabilities we need and what we want to buy. That is important, but it's how do we deter an adversary from employing nuclear weapons against us through a variety of different conventional and nuclear ways. And it has to absolutely be tailored to that potential adversary and then being able to communicate that. And as long as there's some doubt, nobody can predict the future, nobody knows how something would go down, I think that bolsters deterrence, because it kind of forces all states to look for non-military and non-kinetic ways to resolve a lot of these differences we have. And but you never know. I mean, I think the war here in Europe, you know, what Russia's doing against Ukraine, which they've been doing for over a decade now, is a good example of that. We can't always assume that it won't have a conflict dimension to it. So we have to be prepared for that.
I was going to say for NATO tailored deterrence, the B-61 is obviously a key part of that, right? Having a tactical nuclear capability. Here in the Indo-Pacific, a number of nations, at least, you know, some parts of those nations have been very interested in the sea-launched cruise missile, you know, the nuclear capability there, the SLCM-N. I like to say the whole acronym just for the people who aren't, you know, in the know here. So has there been a similar interest in SLCM-N in, you know, NATO and the European theater, or is that, you know, something that is better suited to the Indo-Pacific, do you think?
Well, I think that it is, it's probably a little bit better suited to the Indo-Pacific, and only in that it's a very large oceanic region. And as you know, I mean, the distances involved are significantly different. Whereas in Europe, it's much more land focused and it's a much smaller region. We've certainly, you know, taken a look at it. I think after the Strategic Posture Commission report came out, and it didn't call it the SLCM-N, but there was reference to a nuclear armed sea launch cruise missile, or, you know, something similar to that. And it seems like obviously the U.S. Congress has continued to provide funding for it. So there is some momentum, if you will, inside the United States of potentially fielding that capability at some point. I think from a NATO perspective, again, these are decisions that are made by the United States. We have consultations with the U.S., but inherently it's part of the, you know, the U.S. budgeting and programming process, and Congress is involved and the president, you know, it's an internal U.S. decision. But if the U.S. decides to field such a capability, I just think it would certainly be welcomed out here, because we would figure out how we might be able to potentially utilize that within a NATO context, if that was something that could be provided. In the same way that, you know, with the B-61s, the real value there is, and not so much that it's a tactical nuclear weapon, it's a nuclear weapon that can be employed by Allied dual-capable aircraft. So the fact that the Allies actually can participate in the DCA mission, it gives them an operational role to play. It's not just having a role as, you know, part of the consultations process. It puts skin in the game, if you will. And obviously it's a huge financial commitment. I mean, they're allocating their military forces to train their air crews and their pilots, the infrastructure. And so it's not insignificant, and it gives them a real role to play there. And so that's why I really value the DCA mission here in Europe. It works for us from a geographical perspective. It works for us from a political perspective. It really does sort of show that extended deterrence commitment. So I think it works really well here. But I think there's other theater nuclear forces capabilities we could absolutely consider that could be useful. And whether that's something like a slick amend or whatever the case may be, anything to bolster deterrence, I think is going to be a good thing. In that vein, though, you know, another thing to think about is, again, non-nuclear capabilities that can be added to bolster overall deterrence and defense posture. So I thought it was really interesting when this announcement came out over the summer about the U.S. potentially putting long-range missiles into Germany. Again, they're U.S. capabilities, but Germany is said that it's willing to host them. Well, those are non-nuclear capabilities. They're not nuclear-armed missiles, but that it absolutely could have a deterrence effect. So how can we utilize those to support what we might need for conventional defense if we get into that situation, conflict situation? But I think it is something where it could have a deterrent effect as well. And again, it's a non-nuclear weapon state like Germany. It's a hosting type of support that's provided. And that could also be something that could be considered in the Indo-Pacific region. I mean, obviously, Japan and South Korea already host U.S. Forces. You know, Australia has hosted U.S. forces as well. There's rotational forces. And, you know, from a nuclear perspective, I saw recently, there was a picture I saw online of Japanese F-35s flying with B-2s, I think for the first time. And then just the other day, I saw that there were B-2s, U.S. B-2s that were in Australia and training as part of the U.S. Bomber Task Force with the Royal Australian Air Forces, you know, with different fighter jets and tankers. And again, those are non-nuclear capabilities being provided by Japan and Australia, becoming more interoperable, exercising with U.S. nuclear forces. That's a very powerful signal about the political will of allies to support each other, and very powerful demonstration of capability. I mean, especially when you're thinking about teaming with the advanced capabilities of an F-35 with a stealth bomber, and in the future it'll be the B-21 Raider. That's going to send a very powerful deterrent signal, because potential adversaries see that. They can see how we're interoperable, and it's the fact that we're working together. They understand that political commitment we have. And so there's no doubt, perhaps in their minds, about extended deterrence commitments. And I'm all for thinking about more ways we can use non-nuclear capabilities to bolster nuclear deterrence or strategic deterrence.
Right. Yeah. So do you think some of those, because given this more complicated strategic picture with Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, are some of these demonstrations in the Indo-Pacific, like the ones that you've mentioned with the Japanese F-35s and the B-2s in Australia, do you think they're they're able to send those messages to those adversaries and complicate that picture in the other theatres, like the European theatre as well? So what we're doing in the Indo-Pacific, therefore, then has an impact on, you know, the European theatre.
I don't know how much it's actually picked up on. I mean, I think I probably watch these things because I sort of look at things from more of a global perspective. You know, when the U.S. sends its Bomber Task Force missions over here, those are planned for obviously for deterrence perspectives. But we also use them for public affairs, for reassurance, if you will, the other side of our mission set. So there's a lot of publicity sometimes about that. You know, you see bombers flying overhead, and then, you know, Allied aircraft are joining them. And then again, that's to reassure Allied populations over here of that extended deterrence commitment. I can only assume that, you know, potential adversaries are watching all these things. They're tracking it through various means and probably trying to understand what exactly is going on there. And they probably are watching, you know, which nations are participating with the United States in these bomber task force missions, or, you know, here within NATO, which nations are participating in different types of exercises we have, whether they're conventional or nuclear. I don't know how much the public watches it. I think there's more transparency about these issues. I know we certainly are trying to talk about it more. I mentioned earlier our annual nuclear exercise called Steadfast Noon. We started talking about that more only in the last couple of years so that we could be more transparent about it. I think it'd be good that we talk about it even more to try to normalize some of these things. And it's not to scare anybody. It's not to come across as we're escalatory or just responding to something that the Russians are doing. I think it's just, it's prudent on one hand. I think it's reassuring. And I think it's responsible for us as an alliance of democracies that we talk about these issues. We're not trying to hide it away. We don't, you know, we're not barred up inside authoritarian states. And so it's good that we do talk about these things, and we are beholden to our publics. And so I think we should talk about it more.
Thanks so much, Jim. Would you like to add anything more, Christine or Carl? So that's all. Yeah.
I think clearly we had a lot to talk about. Thanks, Jim, for joining us, you know, tonight or this morning, your time probably.
No, thanks for having me on. It was great. And again, I wish I was there with you in person. It'd be great to get back to Australia at some point. But I'm really happy that we had a chance to talk about these things. Hopefully, you know, listeners will learn a little bit about NATO, but you know, also again, the importance of Australia and our other Indo-Pacific partners to NATO, and again, how we need to look at these challenges from a global perspective and how we can support each other. There's a lot of concern within the world right now, but I think it's great how we are partnering together on these different issues. Yeah.
Jim, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you. And like, I think we really want to keep the conversation going. There's so much to talk about. I think we're probably going to have to do a part two. Natalie, over to you.
Okay.
Thanks so much for being with us on Deterrence Down Under, Jim. We really enjoyed hearing your views on NATO's nuclear policy and its broader relations with its partners in the Indo-Pacific region. We'd like to thank our listeners, and we hope you enjoyed the show as much as we did. And remember to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.